Anyway, thanks so much for agreeing to speak with me. I wanted to start by asking a little bit about your background, your name, you know, where you're from, your education, your career.
Well, I'm Arthur W. Cooper. I was born in Washington, D.C. in 1931. I'm probably the only surviving Washington Senator fan in existence. I graduated from secondary school from school in Maine, and then went to Colgate University and got a bachelor's degree and master's degree there, and a doctor's degree at the University of Michigan. And I came to NC State in 1958, and I've been here ever since, except for about 5.5 years between 1971 and 76 when I worked in state government.
So you would have been a fan of the senator's incarnation that moved to Texas?
Or No, the one that moved to Minnesota.
Okay.
Yeah, no, the Minnesota Twins. And
right.
Yeah, when my father saw when the Twins won the World Series one time, my father was still alive, and he said he didn't see how a grown man could possibly get interested in a team that didn't come from the city where he lived.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I said, as far as I'm concerned, those people still have W's on the front of their shirt.
So Harmon Killebrew, et cetera.
Yeah, it was about Harmon Killebrew's time, and when they left in 1960, 61.
Okay, and as you know, what we're doing is an exhibit about the life and work of B.W. Wells. And you've said elsewhere that you sort of clearly remember your first encounter with the man.
Oh, yeah.
And I wondered if you could...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Very clearly. I had come to NC State, as I said, in the fall of 1958. So I was putting together a course. I was teaching the same course that Wells taught up to a couple of years before with a course in beginning plant ecology. And one day, Wells simply burst into my office, and he didn't without introducing himself. He was brandishing a copy of Ecological Monographs in his hand, and he pointed to it and he said, "Have you read this?" And pointing to an article by Alan Mark, who was had been a student at Duke, and fortunately I could say yes because I had looked at that issue of monographs. And he said, "Well," he said, "you know, I told him how those grass balls were formed. He came out to my farm, and I told him how they were formed, and look at what he's written." Needless to say, he didn't agree with Wells' theory on how they were formed. So my first introduction to Wells was one of when I got a real quick flavor of his enthusiasm and the tenacity with which he stuck to his ideas.
And you've also talked a little bit about how you brought some preconceptions about Wells with you from Michigan. I wondered if you could talk about those and how they squared with the reality of the man.
Well, I was warned when I left Michigan to be careful of Wells. The people at Michigan apparently had the conception, and I think this was to some extent held throughout the ecological fraternity, which in those days was very small. I mean, we're talking 500 or 600 total members of the Ecological Society nationwide in those days. I was warned that that Wells' ideas were off the wall. And I won't use the word that was used to describe him because it's not a very complimentary one, but I was given this advice when I left Ann Arbor. And by the time I had been here a year and had the opportunity to go in the field with BW and to hear him firsthand explain his ideas and then to understand a little bit about the setting in which he worked, I came to understand that the advice that I was given in Michigan was 100% wrong. He was anything but off the wall. His ideas, some of which were very complex and difficult to argue, some of them turned out to be correct even though they were thought to be screwy at the time, and others, of course, turned out not to be correct. But so, it was funny that the advice that I was given, I think, probably reflected a view of the ecological community as much as anything else about his work.
Where do you think that came from?
I have probably two or three reasons. One is that he was a very argumentative person, and he, as I said earlier, he vigorously defended his ideas. So to get in a debate with BW was not a casual thing. If you talked ideas, ecological ideas, with him, he would present his views very strongly. The second thing is that some of his ideas were utilized ideas and information that came from outside the ecological community, and were probably could be defined as a little bit. They certainly were not mainstream ideas. For example, his concept that the Carolina Bays were formed by the impact of meteorites was variously regarded by most people as either not possible or the next thing to insanity. Now, there's one other thing, too, that I think that contributed to Wells, the way people viewed Wells, and that was the fact that he came from NC State, which in those days, when Wells was doing most of his ecological work, the 30s and 40s, NC State did not have much of a national reputation as a research institution, except in a few narrowly defined areas, and most of those were related to agriculture. And I think he was looked upon as a nobody from a small institution with limited capabilities, with some pretty far out ideas.
And in a general way, how do you think you would describe Wells's impact?
How would I describe his impact in
ecology, botany, on North Carolina?
Well, start backwards.
Okay.
Take North Carolina first.
Okay.
His impact in North Carolina was profound. He was I think probably contributed more than any other early botanist to an understanding of the nature of the plant communities that occurred in North Carolina, how they were distributed, and in many cases he provided very sound judgments as to why those communities existed where they did, why, in other words, why they were like they were. Nationally, it's hard to say, because he practiced at a time, and he was publishing primarily at a time when I was still a very young person and didn't have any direct contact with ecology. All I can do is simply comment by inference that I think there were others in North Carolina who probably had less impact on North Carolina ecology, but had a much greater impact nationally than Wells. If that's clear.
Yes, sir. I think so. And you hit on this some, but what were some of the specific research contributions he made?
Well, his first probably major contribution was by most standards a pretty brief paper outlining the natural communities of North Carolina and how they were distributed and where they were located and why they occurred where they did. I can't remember the exact title of the paper, but it was something about the natural communities in North Carolina. And then most of his research from that point on built on some on what he had seen in his field work in the very early days he was in North Carolina. Because that paper to which I referred came out in the probably mid-20s. And there had been no such publication about North Carolina prior to that time.
And for a long time, I guess Wells was more or less the botany department at State.
He and Ivan Shunk.
Right. And how did his personality and agenda sort of shape the direction of the department?
That's a hard question to answer. My answer is going to be a little bit roundabout. One of the things that most people don't appreciate about NC State and was what happened when the university system was consolidated back in the early 1930s during the early part of the Depression. At that time, in an attempt to economize, the state combined its three major universities into one, what was then called the Consolidated University. And in the process of doing that, the legislature made decisions about which kind of programs would go to which institutions. For example, agriculture stayed at NC State and engineering stayed at NC State. But the humanities and the basic sciences, basic biology, for example, were assigned to Chapel Hill, which meant that no advanced degrees in those subjects could be offered at NC State. They had been offered at NC State prior to that time, but they were essentially extinguished at the time of the consolidation, and it was not until well after World War II that NC State was back in the business of offering PhDs in botany. And in fact, the first PhDs in botany from NC State had to get their degrees conferred at Chapel Hill during
So this would have happened during Wells' tenure, the consolidation.
That's
right. In the 30s, he would.
Yeah, and what the point I'm leading up to is that the botany department, by legislative fiat, was limited to offering intensified work only in ecology and physiology. And so because Wells was an ecologist, then his area was one of the areas that the department did stress in its teaching, and they could still do master's work. It was a doctor's work that was limited to Chapel Hill. So Wells, when you say Wells was the department, Wells, not only Wells, but Wells' a subject, was a major part of the department. And the only other one that was of equal importance was plant physiology.
Okay. And you said Shunk and Wells formed the department for a while.
Yeah, I need to add D.B. Anderson to that, too, because Anderson was the physiologist. Shunk was a bacteriologist.
Okay. And how does that work? Because my understanding is that he retired in 54, and you came on board in 58.
Right.
So did he worked as an emeritus professor for a while?
No, he. To my understanding is that he did no teaching after 1954. He was immediately succeeded by a student from Duke, a man named Phil Bordeaux. And Phil taught here 2 years. His actually was Philippe Bordeaux. And when Phil Bordeaux left here, he went to Rwanda, as I recall, because I think Phil was Belgian by extraction. And so Phil had taught 2 years. And then in the 1 year after Phil, they had a 1 year temporary appointment, a woman named Janice Beatley, who got her degree at Ohio State. And then the year 57-58, immediately preceding when I came, there was no ecologist. And what happened was Jim Hardin had come down here to take the plant taxonomy position in 57, and he and I were in Michigan together, and he called me in late 57, early 58, and said, hey, there's a job opening down here in plant ecology, and as far as I can see, they're not making any efforts to fill it. So why don't you indicate an interest in it?
All right. And you worked, my understanding is anyway, you worked professionally with Wells a lot after you retired or nominally retired.
Well, not professionally.
Okay.
They were, in other words, we never published together. We never did research together. I had a lot of contact with him.
Okay.
A lot of, what I guess what you'd call professional contacts with him, in which we discussed issues of interest primarily in ecology.
Okay. And how did these experiences, I guess after his retirement, inform your view of the man? I think I read somewhere that, I mean, you were able to have a pretty successful, I don't know if it was a working relationship, a professional relationship.
Yeah.
Why were you? I mean, why was that such a, I guess, comfortable relationship for you? Or?
Well, one reason was that I was in no, early on, was in no position to challenge his ideas because I didn't know enough about him. So basically, in the early on, my relationship with him was to listen to him, and talk about ecological matters with him. I many times he would give seminars, or I would, you know, in our conversations with him, some of his ideas I wouldn't agree with, and we would discuss those, but there never was an adversarial relationship between us.
And you've touched on this, I think, a little earlier, but I thought I'd raise the question either way. I think you've mentioned somewhere else that Wells is perhaps the least appreciated and the least understood of first-generation ecologists.
Yeah.
And you talked earlier in this interview about, you know, he had more of an impact in North Carolina, but there may have been people in North Carolina who had more of a national impact. Why should this have been the case?
Well, I think it had something to do with his ideas. Some of which were, as I've said, were I can't think the right word to describe them, but they were controversial.
Okay.
His ideas were quite controversial, many of them, and because they were controversial, and because he his podium from which he spoke was a relatively little known institution. His ideas didn't command the success that the ideas of other persons from institutions with higher standing at that time. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. The gentleman who became the ecologist at Duke in the early 1930s, Henry Osting, Heine Osting, was quite well known, and he established Duke as a principal institution in ecology. Wells, in the late 30s, came up with the idea that the growth form of plants near the ocean was due to the wind-blown effects of wind-driven salt spray. And at that time, the prevailing view was that this appearance of those plants was due to the wind. In other words, they were simply wind-trained. And Wells argued that it was salt spray that did it. And in fact, he set out with a series of experiments that he did over an Easter vacation where he used a flit gun. Most people nowadays don't know what a flit gun is, but it was a handheld applicator that you put an insecticide in and then you pump the handle and squirted the insecticide on things. And Wells just filled his flit gun with salt water and squirted it on plants and got the observed effect. And he used this as a proof of the proposition that this form of these plants was due to salt spray and not wind. Well, he gave a talk on this subject at the spring meeting of the North Carolina Academy of Science. And Wells told me himself that when he got done giving that talk, during the question period afterward, one of the well-known professors from Chapel Hill, William Coker, got up and said that something to the effect that your story is very interesting, Wells, and we enjoyed it, but all of us know that it really is the wind that does it. Yeah, sort of a put-down.
Right.
Heine Oesting told me in a class that I taught over here at that state when Oesting was in his latter years, that he and one of his students, Dwight Billings, set out to prove Wells wrong, that his salt spray theory was wrong. In other words, they set up a series of experiments that were deliberately designed to show that it was not salt water but wind. And Heine admitted in front of the entire class, he said, what we proved was that Wells was right. So there was no other interpretation of the data that we got except that it was that the effect was caused by salt spray.
There's Dwight Billings that subsequently went on to become a sociologist in the 70s.
Billings?
Yes, or Dwight Billings. I'm not sure if it's...
No, he was a plant ecologist.
Okay. Could have been a different guy.
Yeah, you're thinking of Gene Odom's father, Howard T. Odom Sr. at Chapel Hill.
Yeah, could be. Why do you think North Carolina proved so particularly useful a laboratory for Wells' work?
Well, for one thing, there had been virtually no ecological work done here before he came. When he came in 1919, I don't believe that there had been much ecological work done in the state at all. I think Frederick Clements, who was one of the original founders of American ecology, had come through North Carolina, and I think he had observed the state and perhaps included his observations in some of his publications, but nothing, there had been no comprehensive work at all done. So he had essentially inherited a blank slate with respect to what would be known, was known about the state's ecology.
And do you think Wells would be comfortable with the direction ecology's taken since he stopped working in it?
Excuse me, let me add one other thing.
Sure.
To what the comment I just made about, it just popped back into my head about Wells. One of the things I think that made North Carolina such a fertile field was that the communities that he looked at, plant communities that he looked at, were communities that were very interesting from an ecological perspective. In other words, there were interesting processes at work in those communities, and I think the processes at work in those communities sort of intermeshed with Wells' extremely fertile mind to produce some very interesting concepts.
Like what, for example, I guess?
Well, one example is the Sandhill Longleaf Pine community, which is was a community that had been almost decimated by turpentining and logging in the 1800s, and there were few remnant stands left when Wells worked here in the early days, and there were but most of it was recovering from fire and all sorts of other destructive forces. Wells was able to work out the relationship between the very dry, sandy environment of the longleaf pine community and the behavior of some of the plants in the community and their interaction with fire. And he developed a picture of the behavior of that community, its interaction with the environment, and then the consequent behavior of the plants that looked like a modern day, by modern day I mean late 1900s example of an ecosystem diagram. In other words, he had diagrammed the relationships between the environment and the plants and all the other factors in force in that community in a way that sort of presaged the thinking that was prevalent during the latter part of the 20th century.
You made some comment a few minutes ago, and maybe I got it wrong, but there was something about the physical environment here or the problems posed by North Carolina that lent themselves especially well to Wells's intellect, or am I?
Well, I guess that probably one of the things that was going on then was reflected by the comments I just made about the longleaf pine community. I said that was a community that was recovering from a couple hundred years of destructive forces. There were a number of other kinds of communities that were also in a state of recovery. Old field, abandoned field communities that occurred in the state were places where natural succession was obviously taking place, because you could come back to the same spot 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years later, and you could actually see change taking place. And in a situation like that where you can see change taking place and can document it, that lends itself to, say, to trying to figure out why it's happening the way it is. And Wells made several contributions in that area. Now, he was not the only one that contributed in that area. Osteen students at Duke did a lot of work in that area.
And I wanted to return to the question of whether Wells would feel comfortable with the direction ecology has taken since he stopped working in it.
Oh, yeah, I think he'd be quite comfortable with it, because he, although he didn't know it at the time, he looked at natural systems as what we now call ecosystems, and we didn't call them ecosystems back in his day. The term had barely been coined when he retired, but he had a sort of holistic view of nature that I think would make him very comfortable in today's environment. Also, the fact that ecology has branched out and now involves thinking from the physical sciences and mathematical sciences, I think is something that he also would approve of very, very much, because he was a pretty eclectic person, and he had interests and knowledge in many fields other than just pure botany.
Thanks again so much for talking with me. Was there anything you wanted to add about life and legacy of B.W. Wells that we didn't cover?
Well, I guess his personality was an interesting personality. He was a very opinionated individual. And hence he argued his ideas very vehemently. So to get into a discussion with B.W. was an interesting intellectual exercise. So and I can remember taking a class, one of the first classes I taught here, on a field trip with him to the coastal plain. This was the spring of 1959, and there were just a half a dozen of us on the whole trip, and we really did nothing but sit and listen to Wells talk and soak up what he had to say. And as a consequence of that, I was able to lead basically the same field trip a year later with a group from Ohio State. came down here. Wells was a terrific teacher. He put his ideas in very simple, clean-cut terms that you could understand. He was also a lot of fun to be around. It was really, really fun to, when out there on his farm, to sit down with him and with a beer. He'd go to the freezer and get a cold beer out, and you sit and talk ecology or talk, you know, Lord knows what. And then later on, when I got very interested and involved in coastal ecology, Wells was very, very interested in that, because he had always had a very, very jaundiced view of development close to the coast.
Right.
He had a very jaundiced view of development close to the coast, and of course I did too, and I was involved in a lot of political efforts to change the way we looked at development on the coast, and BW was very approving of that, and he fed me lots of stuff, you know, ideas to use and his own theories. He was fun to be around.
And he was involved politically in these sort of anti-development type
movies? No, he was too old for that. He made a couple of stabs at being involved late on in his life, but they were not, they didn't do his intellect and himself justice. I don't know whether you can include anything about Maud and
Anything you wanted to share with us, we'd be happy to hear.
Well, Maud Wells, the Mrs. Wells I knew, of course, was the second Mrs. Wells. His first wife died in the 30s. Maud was herself a very bright, energetic, thoroughly enjoyable person to be around. My wife and Maud became very, very friendly, and in fact, after BW died, my wife spent a lot of time with Maud, and the three of us learned things about BW that he didn't even know when he was still alive. Maud was a wonderful person in her own right. Of course, she lived to be nigh on to 100. She was well over 90 when she died.
Well, thanks so much again for talking with me. It's been a real pleasure.
You're entirely welcome.